Coming up.
We were somewhere around Barstow, on the edge of the desert, when the drugs began to take hold.
Turn on, tune in, and listen to Philosophy Talk. Are altered states of awareness the door to a wonderful side of existence that perception alone misses?
You know, a lot's changed since 1967.
No doubt, though, but as long as people are still having promiscuous sex with many anonymous partners without protection, while at the same time experimenting with mind-expanding drugs in a consequence-free environment, I'll be sound as a pound.
Why shouldn't mind-expanding drugs be used to help solve social ills?
Altered consciousness is still too far.
Our guest is artist, scientist, and drug policy reformer Amanda Fielding.
Altered States, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Wow, look at that radio, man.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Allison Gopnik. I'm sitting in today for John Perry, who's away this week.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And Allison and I are here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
And we're continuing a conversation between Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken teaches philosophy, and this week, Tolman Hall at Berkeley, where I teach psychology.
A much superior discipline, I know. It's really nice to have you here, Allison. Now, today, we're thinking about altered states of consciousness.
Now, of course, Ken, you could say that we alter our consciousness all day long with a nice cup of coffee or a relaxing cocktail or even an intense bout of yoga and a sublime walk in the woods.
Yes, we could, and I like those. But the most intense and powerful and direct way of altering consciousness is with mind-altering drugs like LSD or ayahuasca, Allison.
Now, of course, over the years, many people have taken those drugs. But until recently, we didn't understand much scientifically about how the drugs worked. In fact, it's only in the last couple of years that scientists have learned a lot about how psychedelic drugs both affect the brain and expand the mind.
Oh, Allison, science and mind-expanding drugs. You know, it sounds a little back to the future-ish to me.
Oh, Ken, you're thinking of the bad old days of the 60s. Mm. Timothy Leary and his studies of LSD and magic mushrooms.
Yeah, he claimed to be researching the use of psilocybin to rehabilitate prisoners. And he did some work, but what really turned him on and turned a lot of undergraduates on, so to speak, was the spiritual experiences and supposed insights gained during those so-called higher states of consciousness of his.
Look, Ken, I don't want to defend Timothy Leary. He might have started out as a scientist, but pretty quickly he left real science behind. Still, some of the work that he and others did on LSD was important and, in retrospect, turns out to have been pioneering.
Well, Harvard, which fired Leary, and the law, which imprisoned him for a long time, they didn't quite see it that way, Allison.
Well, that's true, but that had a bad effect on science. If we really want to understand consciousness, it would help to understand how consciousness can alter and change. And we might know a lot more about consciousness now if the powers that be then had been more open-minded.
Oh, but that's there's this mythology that psychedelic drugs expand consciousness. But that's not what they do. They distort it. How would hallucinations give you insight into anything real anyway?
Well, if you look at the new research, it turns out that psychedelics actually do seem to expand consciousness.
Oh, come on. Have you been indulging a little bit in your lab there, Allison?
No, you know, nerds like me, Ken. The way we turn on is just by reading more scientific research.
I thought the thing, your thing, was figuring out the minds of kids. That's your thing. What's that got to do with mind-expanding drugs?
Well, actually, Ken, you know, I've been trying for a long time to figure out what's it like to be a baby or a young child. What's consciousness like when you're very young? And it turns out that when people take psilocybin, their brain activity looks a lot like the brain of a very young child.
Okay, and having the brain of a very young child, that's mind-expanding how exactly?
Well, think about how much information preschoolers can take in. They're the best learners we know of in the universe. And not only are they brilliant, but they're remarkably flexible. They think out of the box all the time in ways that we just can't manage when we get grown up.
Okay. So tell me exactly how mind-altering drugs somehow give you back that childlike mental flexibility that you're so fond of. How's that work?
Well, It looks as if the drugs actually make your brain less focused and less coordinated. There's less activity in the prefrontal areas, the ones that control our focus, our goal-directed action, and long-term planning.
But how does having less focus, less control, how does that lead to greater insight? Come on.
Well, what seems to happen with kids is that the fact that they have less control actually gives them a wider focus of attention and a more expanded vision. And when you take these drugs, it's not just that you get a little more aware, you become hyper aware, conscious of everything.
Oh, I get it now. I see. That's why people who are on psychedelics, they feel so creative and create really bad poetry, and they're absolutely blown away by what's actually mediocre music. I get it.
Oh, Ken, you're just a skeptical old square.
Yeah. I am a little skeptical, and I am pretty square, but I'm also worried about the downsides of these drugs. How do you deal with that?
Well, look, I find this new research really exciting, but of course I'm not advocating that ordinary people should go out and drop acid. That would not be a good outcome.
Okay, so here's a question for you. How can we have it both ways? Can we reap the benefits of mind-altering drugs without frying a lot of brains in the process? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, in pursuit of an answer to just that question. She files this report.
I have a few questions for you. How many people in this crowd have seen Molly?
That's Madonna on her 2012 MDNA tour.
Are you ready to dance?
By calling it MDNA, most people assumed Madonna was referring to MDMA, also known as Molly, also known as ecstasy. But before it was a rave fave, ecstasy was a failed attempt to make a cleaning solvent.
Industry's research laboratories are constantly working to discover tomorrow's product today.
MDMA was made by accident in 1912 by the drug company Merck. When it didn't help clean stuff, they tabled it. Half a century or so later, a chemist decided to use it for another purpose, psychotherapy.
Between that period of about 1980 and 1985, there were thousands of therapists who were using MDMA in sessions with people.
Ben Sheckett is with the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. They research the medical use of mind-altering drugs.
We're looking for applications for use in treating psychological disorders, like post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety, anxiety associated with life-threatening illness.
MDMA, or ecstasy, is illegal to take recreationally, but researchers can get government approval to look at its medicinal benefits. The MAPS team is currently doing clinical trials to see how the drug might help people with PTSD.
It's not given in isolation, so we're not just giving somebody a drug and then sticking them in a room for 8 hours.
In the studies, people with PTSD get really, really high on ecstasy, in the company of a sober therapist. In between those trips, they have drug-free therapy sessions. Meanwhile, another control group also receives therapy, but without drugs. Patients who took MDMA report better mental health results.
So MDMA is used as a catalyst for a deeper therapeutic process than would be possible in regular talk therapy or with a drug like an antidepressant SSRI or something like that.
Sheckett says when people have PTSD, their nervous system is kind of stuck in a loop.
There's this sort of self-reinforcing message of like, I'm not safe, I'm not safe, I'm not safe.
MDMA makes people feel safe and happy. They like other people. And most importantly for the researchers, they like themselves. That self-hate associated with PTSD subsides.
And so having access to these sort of internal resources of self-love and self-compassion are very important for the healing process.
If you're on ecstasy, here's why all you need is love.
MDMA functions as a catalyst for serotonin release in the brain, meaning it dumps a lot into the synaptic clefts at once. So there's a tremendous sense of positive mood or of well-being.
In addition, research by MAPS and others is looking at the therapeutic benefits of a slate of psychedelic drugs, ayahuasca, peyote, mescaline, and LSD.
A lot of that work is being done on LSD's effects on what's called the default mode network, which is this large section of the brain that's consuming an enormous amount of energy, and we can't really figure out exactly what it's for. It seems to be correlated with things like daydreaming or like rumination.
LSD decreases the activity in that part of the brain, making people more able to remain present. That's really good for study participants with high anxiety or PTSD. Sheckett says there's no doubt that being in an altered state can provide meaningful insight.
But I think it's important to kind of recognize that it's not the drug. The drug is giving you an experience of yourself. If you talk to people who've had very meaningful psychedelic experiences, it wasn't meaningful because they were in some weird state of consciousness. It was meaningful because they recognized that it was something true and authentic about themselves that was emerging.
Ben Sheckett and the team at the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies believe that psychedelics should be legal. One day. People need to know that such drugs can be used for psychological healing. But first, they need to be reintroduced in a medical context. Until then, MDMA stays in the lab. Mostly.
Are you ready to dance?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Are you ready to make some noise?
Thanks, Shuka. That's fascinating. I'm Allison Gopnik, sitting in for John Perry, who's away, and I'm here with Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about what we can learn about consciousness through the study of drug-induced altered states. We're joined now by Amanda Fielding. She's founder and director of the Beckley Foundation, a think tank on drug policy and scientific research into psychoactive substances. She's also the Countess of Weems and March, first Countess ever on Philosophy Talk. Amanda, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, thank you very much.
Amanda, I know you've led an amazing life, and we could probably spend the entire hour just talking about that. But if you had to pinpoint just one time in your life that got you started on thinking about psychedelics and consciousness, what would that be?
Wow, I wonder. I suppose I grew up in an incredibly isolated place on the edge of a moor, and I had nothing much to do except mooch around and think about things. And then my godfather was a Buddhist monk, and that always rather inspired me. And I got involved in studying very young about comparative religions and mysticism. And I studied under the leading professor when I was 16 at Oxford, called Zaina. And then I was introduced to LSD in 1965. And I realized that produced a sensation very much like an experience, very much like what I was studying in about the mystics. And so then a little bit later, in 1966, I met a Dutch scientist who had a description of how it psychedelics and other means of altering consciousness have their effects through changing the physiology of the brain, through changing the blood supply. And then I got passionately interested in that side of understanding what are the mechanisms underlying altered states of consciousness.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, as you say, back in the early 60s, there was a lot of science, and then it kind of shut down for 40 years. Why do you think there's been this great resurgence just in the past few years?
Well, I think it shut down because, as you know, LSD got out of the laboratories in the early 60s and spread like wildfire and brought about the kind of cultural evolution, which then kind of the establishment panicked and decided to prohibit the whole thing and throw the baby out with the bathwater, basically. And so all scientific research was closed down for 50 years, more or less. So during that time, I was passionate about the subject and desperate to research it. And but it was fairly impossible until the development of brain imaging technology, which happened in the 80s, 90s kind of thing. And then I realized one could correlate what was happening in the brain with the subjective experiences. So for the first time, you could really get an empirical idea of what mechanisms underlay the changes in consciousness.
And Amanda, so there was new possibilities for scientific research because of the developing technology and all that. But so did the British government or the American government or somehow just were they convinced to relent there? Because in the U.S., you can't study this stuff still without special dispensation from the government.
Absolutely. No. They weren't at all like that. In fact, the whole subject of consciousness was taboo until about 10, 15 years ago. But altered states of consciousness was way off the pale. There was no question that you could study it. And that was appalling because it actually, in the years of the 50s, there were 3,000 research studies done into it. It was the new wonder drug, LSD, and it had very promising possibilities. I mean, the science wasn't all that, carefully done, but it showed the possibility of a lot of healing in things like addiction and mood disorders. So it was a disaster shutting it down. And for psychotherapy, it was wonderful.
So, and, you know, we're going to have to dig. There's a lot here. I mean, I can tell you have a wealth of experience and knowledge, and we're going to try to mine as much of that as possible. We've got to take a little break. So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about altered states of consciousness.
Have you ever taken psychedelics or other mind-altering substances? Did your consciousness expand? Did you develop any lasting insights, or did you just feel confused?
Psychedelics, consciousness, and the brain, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, Timothy Leary may be dead, but work on psychedelics lives on in recent research. I'm Allison Gopnik, sitting in for John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about altered states of consciousness.
Our guest today is Amanda Fielding, founder and director of the Beckley Foundation.
Amanda, there's so much I want to talk to you about. Now, I have to admit something. I don't have any experience with psychedelics. And there's a little thing I'm puzzled about, because people report that these psychedelic experiences, they're not like dreams. They attest to their authenticity, to their veridicality. But I don't understand how messing with your brain chemistry to such a degree that you hallucinate can provide you with this feeling of authentic insight into the world. Can you tell me how that's supposed to work?
Well, that's really what our research is investigating, is what are the mechanisms which give people the mystical experience or the feeling that they have new insights and new understanding of themselves. And basically what we have found through using the latest brain imaging technology is that within the brain there are different networks, and high up networks which control what reaches consciousness. One very dominant one is called the default mode network. And that senses what reaches our consciousness, and it evolves. We aren't bored with it. We develop it with speech and learning and as we grow up, and it becomes more and more fixed and senses and represses what gets into consciousness and keeps everything balanced. Well, what we noticed when we did the first psilocybin study at the Beckley Imperial Research Program, which I set up with Professor David Nutt in 2005, I think it was that the blood supply to this high-up center network and other related networks was reduced, so that the function of the default mode network in repressing sensations coming from sensory or emotional or other parts of the brain diminished. So suddenly this controlling part, which is like the conductor in the orchestra, was put to rest, and the brain cross-communicated the whole brain.
Right.
And that changed the sense of consciousness.
I get you. That's really fascinating. I still have a question about that, though. So why, though, once you get back and let the default mode network back into control, does it not think of those things as, well, it was like a dream or something? It thinks of those, it seems, from what the literature I've read, that people think of that as that new stuff, as genuine insight, as authentic, and not,
Yes.
Why is that? Why doesn't the default network say, oh, that was, I was out of control, I was asleep, I went crazy, forget it?
Well, I think sometimes it does, but also people very often rate these experiences as among the five most important experiences of their lives.
Right.
That was an experience done in John Hopkins, where It's like the birth of their first baby or something really which changes them. And usually it's changing them for the better. They people I know who've discovered things through it or started some charitable thing or changed their whole viewpoint through one of these psychedelic experiences. Because suddenly the old shadows, the old veils fall away and you see reality in a fresher, brighter way. It's as if consciousness, maybe this will be interesting to you, Alison, it's like regaining the primary consciousness of a child, a baby, before the default mode network builds up to censor everything, so everything goes through the filter of censorship and verbal control.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why it's interesting, is there's a kind of trade-off where as a baby or a young child, you can easily find out things that are new, think of new ideas. But, of course, you're not as good at actually controlling the way that you work around the world. Now, for babies and young children, we have grown-ups and parents to take care of them, to supervise that. For adults, most of the time, we have to rely on our default networks. But sometimes we can actually get back to that.
So it sounds like the two of you are suggesting. Tell me if this is the right sum up of what the two of you are saying. Look, babies, they're in a way hyper-aware. They're more hyper-aware. They're less, there's less filtering that they have going on. The stuff that they don't filter out, that we do filter out, is real stuff.
Exactly.
Right? Yes. It's real stuff. Yes. But for us adults, paying attention to that would be noisy and intrusive and disruptive. So when the default network is shut down, it gets back to being conscious. It's not just hallucinations or stuff. It's, I mean, there may be some of that, but there's also real stuff that we're aware of, like the quality of that music that we miss because we've not learned to let it all filter in. So it turning off the filter gives us more consciousness. Being an adult and having the filter gives us more focus, and the drugs help us. Yeah. I mean, is that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a wonderful quote from, there's some wonderful quotes from William Wordsworth, who described the way that we come into the world trailing wings of glory. So we are actually perceiving more of the world when we're young than we do when we're old. And, you know, Ken, the philosopher Dan Dennett talked about what he called the user illusion. So really, our everyday experience, in a way, is just another hallucination that our brain is giving us. And the one we usually have as grown-ups is one that's got certain kinds of qualities. It's narrow. Yeah. It filters things out. The one that we had as children and the one that we seem to have, judging from the studies in under the influence of psychedelics, is a different way of experiencing the world. But it's not necessarily that one of them is right and one of them is wrong.
What do you think about that, Amanda?
And I think there's an advantage. I mean, to have the default mode in action, to be able to concentrate and do tasks, is absolutely essential. I mean, that's how, as an animal, we've done all the incredibly brilliant things we've done. But it can get stuck in an over-rigid setting. And that's what really is underlying a lot of mental illnesses, like depression, anxiety, OCD, addictions. And that is where these substances can shake the rigid patterns and seemingly, from the research we've been doing, bring about remarkable treatment possibilities for these intractable illnesses. And but that's not the only thing, because it also can bring inspiration and insights to healthy people. So I think both forms of consciousness have immense value. And I think modern society has made a mistake in criminalizing these altered states of consciousness, because historically they were always at the center of our cultural evolution.
Amanda, you get made lots of claims there, and I agree with a lot of them, and I wonder about some of them. But let's see what some of our callers think. You're listening to a philosophy talk. We're talking about altered states of consciousness with Amanda Fielding and with Alison Gopnik as my guest host today. And we've got Mike in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mike.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the call, and it's a subject near and dear to my heart. LSD definitely opened the door. I took it recreationally, but it opened the door to perceptions of my own behavior that were an issue. And, you know, I kind of pursued therapy and asked and talked to my therapist about it, and he introduced me to the work of Stan Grof. And Stanislav Grof was brought to John Hopkins, I think in 67, but right after he was the preeminent LSD researcher from Prague at the time. And shortly thereafter, they took the funding away, and he ended up at Esalen and created, went on a journey to try to create the same type of brain activity and simulate it without using the drug itself and trying to do it holistically and develop holotropic breath.
So, Mike, is your question for us whether you can do the get into the same kind of state without the benefit of drugs?
There you go. Yeah, okay. I mean, in my experience, I did. It wasn't exactly the same, but it had a lot of similar results. I was just curious.
Okay, I'm going to put
what you guys think of that possibly.
Thanks for the question. I'm going to put that to Amanda. Can you get into these same kind of states through other forms of various mental disciplines, for example?
I think you can get near them or to them, but with immense training and extra trouble. I mean, psychedelics can, in a very safe and known way, get you there. And the important thing to remember about, particularly LSD, but all of them, is that they're very dose sensitive. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have this enormous experience which frightens people, like maybe in the 60s was the kind of custom. It's possible to take LSD in a micro dose, a little, which just gives a sparkle, or a medium dose, so you go to a museum and see beautiful art. Do you see what I mean?
Yes,
it's
I do see what
very
you mean.
Very different areas.
I want to put another kind of question to you. Because when you were talking about depression and OCD and Allison's remarks about Dennett, because Dennett thinks the self is kind of an illusion. He calls it the center of narrative gravity, but it's a fictional kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff I've read about this made me think, well, certain disorders may be what I'll call disorders of excessive selfhood. That is, yeah. I mean, the self is a cool thing. It organizes your mental life, right? You use it to guide your activity. It integrates all this stuff. The Eastern philosophy says, transcend the self, be more aware, be more one. And look, you break down this boundary between self and others, you know, your consciousness expands, the Easterners say. And it sounds like you think LSD does do that. It's, in some ways, it breaks down these centers of control that are deeply constitutive of selfhood. But one of the downside benefits, I mean, the upside benefits of this for the treatments of disorder, it makes me think that some of these disorders might be like the selfhood gone wild. You are so concerned with every move that you make, so hyper attentive to the self. And so you shouldn't think of them as like, sometimes you think of schizophrenia or something like that as fragmented selfhood. But some forms may be like super excessive selfhood. Is that a reasonable thought?
I think it is. The self becomes too rigid. The pattern underlying these networks becomes so rigid that it kind of imprisons the person. And what a psychedelic does, as we see from our research, is that the blood supply to these censoring networks is reduced. So suddenly, all the rest, all the other parts of the brain are talking to each other. So there's a unified, and that underlies the experience of ego dissolution, the experience that the mystics have of being part of the universe, unified with the whole. And one can see that in brain imaging. The visual cortex, for instance, is connected to all the emotional and memory, and there's a flood of connectivity through the brain, through parts of the brain which normally never talk to each other. And that can be very healthy, can bring new insights and reset brains which have got set into this rigid negative patterns. That's what we're slowly developing the idea of. And that's what's been shown in our recent a psilocybin depression study, which we published in Lancet Psychiatry last week.
Amanda, you know, I think it's really interesting from the developmental perspective, because, of course, we know that what happens with development is that early on, you've really got a kind of brain and a half. Connections are being made all throughout the brain. And we develop more synapses in the first couple of years of life than we ever have later on. What happens as we get older is that we prune a lot of those connections. Yes. So we actually keep some of them, but we discard a lot. So in a way, the picture that you're talking about, a metaphor that I've used in my research, is thinking about it as being sort of like a high temperature versus a low temperature. So you've got an early brain that's bouncing around a lot, moving around from place to place. If you have either hung out with four-year-olds or seen people under the influence of certain psychoactive substances, you see this kind of bouncing around. Yeah. And that's really good for discovery, for learning, for creativity. And then you have a brain that kind of cools down and just does things in little local places, and that looks more like the adult brain.
Michael in Boston's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yes, hello. At a fundamental level, I think psychedelics bring up a strong challenge to the notion of dualism, which even if it's not popular in philosophical and scientific circles, is still a strong part of the demonic religion in our culture. If a molecule or a railroad spike through the brain, in the case of one worker in the 19th century, can cause a personality change, what does this say about the nature of spirit and flesh? Yeah. And if you're a Thomist, can the wrong molecule move you from a state of grace to a state of sin?
I get you, Michael. So your point is, look, these mind-altering drugs have such powerful effects and predictable and systematic effects on the self and consciousness and all that stuff. Then once you see that and you see how it does it by working in the brain, the idea that the self is something separate and distinct, or the mind is something separate or distinct, or that consciousness is immaterial, kind of goes away. What do you think about that, Amanda? Thanks for the call, Michael. What do you think about that, Amanda, briefly, because then we'll transition to a break?
Well, I think the self forms from in conditioning and what happens in life. And sometimes it forms in a wonderful way, and sometimes it has traumas which leave deep scars and need to be reset. And the great thing in historically, these substances were used as medicine and for spirituality and for group cohesion, but they were used in the society. It was part, there was a ritual use which kind of protected the individuals and made the bonding between the individuals greater, and the spiritual life of the experience greater. And we've lost that, and through kind of prohibition, they've got much more demonized, sadly, these substances. And I think they need to be reintegrated, and that's why I'm very set out right back in 66 to do the very best research.
Right, but I want to, after a break, I want to explore, though, how these drugs and their effects help us understand better the nature of the self and the nature of consciousness. Because I'm a philosopher, and those things interest me a lot. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about altered states of consciousness with Amanda Fielding, founder and director of the Beckley Foundation.
If psychedelic drugs have so much potential to cure depression or trauma or addiction, should they be legalized? And how can our drug policies be reformed so that we can conduct more scientific research into those substances?
The future of psychedelics, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Are you experienced? Or have you ever been experienced? Well, I have.
What's it like to be psychedelically experienced? Could we all benefit from greater access to mind-expanding drugs? I'm Allison Gopnik, sitting in today for John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is artist, scientist, and drug policy reformer Amanda Fielding, and we're thinking about altered states of consciousness.
Amanda, I know you've been fighting for a long time just to get approval to do this research. And it's sort of striking that the research that you and your colleagues like Robin Carhart-Harris have been doing, research that involves giving people doses of these psychedelic drugs in very controlled, safe settings with therapists on hand and lots of support, have been getting these really strikingly positive results. And they've also been getting a lot of attention. What do you think is going to happen next? What will happen over the next 5 to 10 years with psychedelic research?
I think what we're doing is building the building bricks of an evidence base which shows that these substances, these compounds, can have amazingly healing and beneficial power for the individual and therefore for society. And We need to make use of them as incredible tools for psychotherapy, for moving rigid states of thought patterns, of exploring our inner selves and stimulating creativity. And what I've been doing over the last 20 years or so is building up collaborative working partnerships with different scientists who are willing to undertake this research around the world. So apart from doing it with Imperial College, I've also done some wonderful work in collaboration with Johns Hopkins.
Amanda, so this is really cool, but the question, one question is, the thing that stood in the way of this research for a long time is, I don't know about in Britain, I think in Britain too, but in the United States, the government. The government has this drug as a Schedule I drug, which says you can't, it has no medical benefits, you can't use it regularly. It's, and to get the dispensation to even study it, you've got to apply for an exception. And the government has granted an exception in the Johns Hopkins and to some other people. Yeah. And I gather they're now in stage 3 clinical trials on some of this stuff, which means that if they pass the stage 3 clinical trials, it will be certified as having medical benefits, and it will no longer be a Schedule I drug. You'll only be able to get it by prescription. That would be an explosion. I mean, if that happens, which it looks like it might, that would be an explosion.
Well, they aren't yet in phase 3, but heading in that direction. And that's very, very exciting. And actually, just I came from a lunch where I was sitting next to the Prime Minister, which was very nice, and I said that really these substances should be moved from Schedule 1 at least to Schedule 2 so that they can be researched and doctors can prescribe them, because now there is enough evidence to show that they're incredibly valuable compounds for treating illnesses apart from their other benefits. And it's time we move beyond this this kind of constriction of prohibition.
So let me ask you a question. So it sounds like Britain and the U.S. regard these drugs as pretty much the same way. But does the whole industrialized world have the same attitude? Are they all the equivalent of Schedule I drugs in all developed scientific countries?
Yes, but a lot of countries are wanting to reform drug policy, and that's one of the things I've been working on for the last 20 years. I mean, Portugal's decriminalized all drug use, and that's had very, very positive effects of cutting down misuse of drugs and cutting down their heroin levels and all sorts of damages. I mean, Jamaica is wanting to have just recognized the spiritual, sacramental value of cannabis and is wanting to create a regulated market. And in Latin America, they've realized that is a disaster, our drug policy, which is making their world,
So I want to ask a different kind of question. This is speculative. I'm a philosopher, so I get to do this. I want to speculate because I am interested as a human being in the therapeutic payoffs and all that stuff and the medicinal payoff. I'm interested in that. But I'm also interested in what this teaches us about the fundamental nature of mind, self, and consciousness. Yes. Right? And it seems to me that it's bordering on a revolution in our understanding of what a mind is, how a mind built, how consciousness works, and especially also of what I think of as one of the highest achievements, evolutionary achievements, selfhood. I know some people think self is an illusion. I think it's a really super duper high evolutionary achievement. And it seems to me that this research has the possibility of giving us deep understanding of how selfhood arises from the organized brain. Do you think that's right or not?
I totally agree. And that's why I've, from the very beginning, got into this area of studying. I think there's nothing more fascinating than understanding more about human consciousness. As the Delphic Oracle said, know yourself. And these substances are amazing keys to understanding the self because they change the nature of consciousness so one can compare that consciousness with daily consciousness. And from that, one learns an enormous amount about how consciousness works, what are the mechanisms underlying, what is the change in blood supply, in neural activity, in brain waves, and we can learn about consciousness. And surely there's really almost nothing more important than that, and we can learn about selfhood. And right. what I feel is that under the psychedelic state, when the repressive power of the default mode network and other censoring networks is reduced, suddenly the self becomes more complete, more unified. It's a different type of self. We're back to the self of primary consciousness, of the baby. And it doesn't mean to say that one wants to live there, but one wants to experience it and absorb it and integrate it into one's selfhood.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, of course, from a scientific perspective, the what's sometimes called the hard question, how do we actually have consciousness at all, something that scientists have been paying more and more attention to. And one of the
following
things,
the lead of us philosophers.
Following, well, or in spite of the prohibitions of philosophers. And, of course, having an actual experimental way of altering that phenomenology, yes. that consciousness, that experience, is a great scientific tool. And one of the things that I find extremely interesting about this is a lot of the theories of how consciousness works that came from those philosophers depended on the idea that, for instance, you needed to have a sense of self, or you needed to have yes. language, or you needed to have a default network. You yeah. needed to be able to have what some people call a global workspace to have consciousness at all. Yeah. And I think yeah. that this research actually just turns that on its head.
Well, I think those theories of consciousness are lousy theories of consciousness, but I think people were confused a lot and didn't focus enough on the self, on selfhood, what I call selfhood, the being, the process of being an agent in the world who's self-aware and has a point of view and all that. That's not the hard problem of consciousness. That's a different problem. It's related. The hard problem of consciousness is about the qualitative character of experience. That's a hard problem. But yeah. what I think that LSD is showing us is something not so much about the so-called hard problem, but something about how selfhood. Freud believed that the self was generated by the mechanisms of the brain somehow, right? It was a generated thing. And I think he's exactly right. And I think we all should yeah. be Freudians now. And I'm not yeah. saying his precise theory of how the self is generated was right. But I actually think yeah. LSD is giving us a deep insight into how selfhood
Absolutely.
Is generated.
I totally agree. And the default mode network is the physiological basis of the ego. Mm-hmm. It very much comes, you know, I was always fascinated by Freud, and then in the 1960s I saw the ego as a conditioned reflex mechanism which directed the blood supply in the brain. And that's what our research now with brain imaging is beginning to show. And that's the excitement, is that in the 60s you could imagine how it was, but it's only with brain imaging that you can actually correlate what you imagine to the reality of the changes you can observe in the brain.
But Amanda, I think Allison disagrees with us. I'll give you a chance.
Well, I'm not sure that I disagree, but one thing that I would say is that you know, a lot of our understanding about consciousness and things like our identification of consciousness with the self has come from those philosophers, and I'm afraid psychologists too, sitting in an armchair and thinking about the kind of consciousness that we yeah. have most of the time, which is mostly sitting there desperately either trying to figure something else yeah. or keep ourselves from being distracted from figuring something out. Yeah. And it can be incredibly informative to think yes. about all those other ways of experiencing and being in the world, whether yeah. it's by taking a psychedelic or hanging out with a 4-year-old.
Oh, I totally agree yeah. with that. I totally agree.
I totally agree too.
Yeah, I think we're having an intense agreement here.
Yeah, we really are. And I don't want to overplay brain imaging technology because it's a new science and it's full of mistakes.
Oh yes.
But it can.
I'm glad you said that.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's how you interpret it. So it can go anywhere, and we all know that. But it does give. It's like I think psychedelics is like the telescope to, mm-hmm. You know, it suddenly enables one to change our consciousness into the higher level of human consciousness, into the mystical experience, into the creative breakthrough mode, into kind of transcendence and joy. And then we can, you know, compare and integrate that into our daily consciousness. And I think we need to integrate these substances into human culture, modern culture again.
You know, it's interesting because William James, who was, after all, the founder yeah. of psychology,
His very first book was about how we could get a scientific hold on what looked like these very elusive aspects of human experience. We all know that they're there. We all know that we have
these capacities. He was a great user. Well, not a great user, but he used psychedelics.
Yeah.
And he wrote a lot about it in his...
And he was the first one to really kind of... He's the father of neuroscience, in a sense, because he started to take the veils away, didn't he? He saw consciousness is shrouded in veils, and that when one takes a substance, one can see through those veils.
So, you know, Amanda, unfortunately, I think we're just getting started. I mean, we're just getting... Yes. But this is what happens in Philosophy Talk. There's a lot of ramping up and now, but unfortunately, we're at the end of our hour. So I'm going to have to thank you for joining us, and I hope we get a chance to talk again sometime. But thank you so very much.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Our guest has been Amanda Fielding. She's a founder and director of the Beckley Foundation. It's a really advanced think tank on drug policy and scientific research into psychoactive substances. And I want to give a special thanks to you, Allison, for stepping in John Perry's absence. It's been a great pleasure having you as a co-host.
Well, I love being on Philosophy Talk, one of my favorite radio programs.
Well, and come back anytime as guest or co-host. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community, and please do, by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at PhilTalkRadio. And now let's hear from someone with an altered sense of speed. It's Ian Scholes, 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, opioid drugs are suddenly hammering an alarming number of American senses into that dull glow we call happiness. Junkies once again walk among us, or nod off among us, I suppose. In the 80s and 90s, stimulants were the life-destroying drug of choice. But in the 60s and early 70s, when colors were bright, smiles were dreamy, and men wore dickies, the drugs were mind expanders, or so we told ourselves. Marijuana was the gateway drug, generally used to help one sit on the porch on a hot summer day, listening to whole album sides on the FM radio station while giggling at the dog. This led to psychedelic drugs, which might be considered the 80-proof rye whiskey to the 3.2 beer of marijuana, more intense anyway. The ingestion of peyote, mescaline, LSD, and their sub-ilks were done by two types of hippies, those who yearn for wisdom and epiphanies, your Timothy Leary, and those who yearn to giggle at the dog on both the cosmic and subatomic level, your Ken Kesey. Then, the atavistic urge for employment took hold of our society. Psychedelia more or less went by the cultural wayside as we gained access to cocaine, prescription drugs, and new-age anxiety therapy strategies. But psychedelia is still with us in movies, books, music. Maybe you don't listen to Inagata de Vida or curl up with Hermann Hesse of an evening, but trippy movies like 2001 A Space Odyssey are still watched. Drugs, of course, have always had a huge effect on our culture. We had Miami Vice and Scarface as the epitome of cocaine culture. Tony Montana was so hopped up on the blow, it took a dozen guys and machine guns to kill him. What about the ultimate psychedelic movie? Well, there are so many, including The Trip with Peter Fonda, Easy Rider, 2001, of course, Yellow Submarine, Fritz the Cat, Fantastic Voyage, and on through the years of The Razorhead, Repo Man, Zardoz, Brazil, Willy Wonka, Barbarella, Fantasia, El Topo, Donnie Darko, and the trippiest of them all, Kolyanaskatsi. People don't drop acid to watch movies so much anymore, if they ever did. I think more people went to trippy movies to pretend they were hippies, the way people went to Rocky Horror Picture Show to pretend they were decadent. Nobody really wanted to be hippie. America hates hippies. And yet we love stoner movies. They're still with us. Cheech and Chong, Dude Where's My Car, Harold and Kumar, Napoleon Dynamite, which is kind of a stoner movie for Mormons. Most recently, we have Broad City, a feminist stoner series, you might say, about two women who smoke a lot of pot. After all this time, marijuana is well on its way to universal acceptance. I doubt this will happen with LSD, even though psychedelic drugs have therapeutic values we are only beginning to understand. We would much rather hang out with Cheech and Chong than Timothy Leary, and marijuana is probably much more useful than LSD if you want to pre-associate. Not so good to memorize a set of random numbers, but if you want to examine which random numbers look like cartoon animals, well, pot is perfect. A case could be made, though, that the majority of movies today seem to be made by people on LSD. Giant robots turning into robots to fight other robots. People with weird superpowers getting into fistfights for no apparent reason. Now, when I was a long-haired tad, we only used the word awesome to describe something that was actually awesome, like the Northern Lights or Inagata de Vida. Today, awesome just means cute. But back then, we didn't need a prescription for pot. Just $5. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.